qualified equipment. We want non-Brillhas. We need reliability. Whereas you develop these dendrites with the materials that are in non-lead-bearing solder, which eventually give you a short circuit across your printed circuit or inside your integrated circuit. So they haven't really solved all the Rojas problems. Very similar to what's going on with, I can't think of the name of the substance that's used as a gas to do fire extinguishing. It's no longer allowed to be used. What's the name of that stuff?
Halogen?
It's a halogen, but what is it called?
Halon.
Halon, right. Halon is a beautiful fire retardant material. And they've turned the world upside down looking for a replacement that's not a chlorofluorocarbon that affects the ozone layer. And to my knowledge, they haven't found anything close to the performance of halon. Well, to my knowledge, they haven't found anything that's close to the performance of lead-bearing solder. So, we're not out of the woods on all these things yet. Back to you, Mel. And what's your mailbag like? K2RIW over to K2KEY.
Okay, to K2KEY. And one more comment about CW. I have a program, being also a very avid CW operator for so many years. I had a major gadget up that was in the handbook, where you can send or receive CW keyboard watching CW signal on the monitor. And yet, many times with the monitor, I see where this, for some reason, because that's USB and all, the computer cannot pick up the CW copy. I can get by ear perfect copy. So I think the best computer, for copying CW in many cases, I believe, is the human ear, but between the two human ears over.
You're absolutely right. And there's a couple things going on there. Some of it is syntax. In other words, I could be writing you a letter where I'm printing out the letters, and I'm writing you a mail letter, and I'm about to mail it to you, and I leave out certain letters, and you would be able to easily put it back because of the way it fits into the speech. To write a program to do that is very difficult. High-speed Morse code operators do something very different from a beginner. A beginner learns that dida is A, da did is N, and so on. And he hears individual letters. Eventually, as you develop more and more code proficiency, you don't hear letters, you hear words. The word bent, B-E-N-T, for instance, has got a very characteristic sound to it. Da did it, did da did da. It's got a swing to it. Well, you can recognize, and T-H-E, da did it, did. You hear the whole darn word after a while. Well, guys who are extremely good at high-speed code, they don't hear letters, they don't hear words, they hear sentences or fractions of sentences. They recognize that the composition of English language is such that certain sentences have a certain characteristic sound, and they can listen to that sound at 65 words a minute. I forget now what the Morse code listening speed is for a human being, but it's extremely high. It just sounds like a blur to the majority of us listening to that. And how can a human brain be trained to do that? I call it an acquired reflex. The people who study Morse code, if you really go a little bit slow with the process and recognize what's going on, I recognize the fact that when I was 16 years of age, learning Morse code with my buddy, Bob Nielsen, K2RJB with his call letters, and I became K2RIW. He and I were sending Morse code to each other, and we recognized that during each practice session that lasted for a half hour or an hour, not much change in code speed occurred. Overnight, the code speed changed. In other words, we would do practice on Tuesday, and from the beginning of the hour on Tuesday to the end of the hour on Tuesday, if anything, because of fatigue, my code speed at the end of the hour was a little bit slower. I'd come back on Wednesday, and all of a sudden I'm listening to code three words a minute faster than I did on Tuesday. The human brain works on the problem overnight, and all of a sudden you get more proficiency the next day. Somewhere around 8, 9, 10 words a minute, depends on each individual, you hear a sound, your hand writes down the letter, you look at the page and say, who did that? And you suddenly realize the brain is skipping many of the procedures of hearing the tone, converting the dits and dahs into dots and dashes, going to a lookup table and say, hey, that's the letter A, and writing down, this is the way I write down the letter A, and then you write down the letter A. There's about 5 steps to that process, at least. All of a sudden, the brain hears the sound, your hand moves, and you say, who did that? Well, we all forget about that. Later on, we learn to listen to Morse code with later more and more delay between what you're hearing and what you're writing, and that you have to do that because certain letters, like words that have multiple E's and I's, which fly by very fast, if you didn't lag, you would be trying to write above your writing speed. Write down the alphabet and you know exactly what letter is coming next, and most people cannot write any faster than about 23 words a minute. And there are people that can listen to 40, 50, 60, 60, and 80 words a minute. Obviously, they're not writing it. They're doing something else, some kind of shorthand or typing or whatever. So, a complicated process. But you recognize the fist of a person, you can have missing letters, you can put it back together. However, there is a place where the computer does a better job. On the WSJT, I think it's called, the K2 Joe Taylor technique of... that he has recently invented, where a series of 4 tones are sent in various combinations. A good computer program running on the WSJT technique is able to hear a signal that is 28 dB below the noise level of that receiver. It's able to dig that signal out of the noise and give you nearly perfect Morse code, printed across the screen of the computer. So, certain kinds of Reed-Solomon based Morse code-like transmitting techniques are capable of giving you very high performance out of very weak signals. A human ear listening to that signal at minus 28 dB signal-to-noise ratio says absolutely nothing is there. And yet your computer is listening to that gobbledygook and typing out words across the screen with 99% accuracy of copy. And there's also a cyclic redundancy code or a parity check or whatever built into the system so that even if it gets an error, it tells you when the error was there. And in theory, the system can tell the transmitter, please repeat block number 14. I didn't get solid copy of that. And this all happens in packet-like system automatically. So there are modified Morse code-like systems that are better than the conventional Morse code. Not better for a human hearing system, but better for the qualities of a computer. And so, when the people first started experimenting with Morse code interpreting programs, and I guess that took place way back in the late 60s, I do remember one of the guys at ARRL having experimented with that in the late 60s and had moderate success with it. Who would ever think that you'd come up with a Morse code-like system a few years later that exceeds what a human ear can do? And is this the end of the line? Guarantee that more things are going to be invented. You haven't heard the end of the story yet. Hang in there. K2KUY, K2LIW.
Roger, this is
K2KUY.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Fabulous. The lights is out today. That really, quite amazing. That's the only way to put it. Yeah, I can recognize certain things at very high speed, such as the word text, dot, you know, at very, very high speed. So, also I used to, from listening to a lot of RTTY years ago, I got to just hear by the CQ tone of RTTY, I got to recognize that guy was called CQ before I put the teletype machine on. One of the most amazing, not the most amazing, displays of CW was many years ago, let's say 1958, graduated high school, and an uncle of mine gave me as a graduation present from Brooklyn Tech at the time a trip to Washington, the ARRL convention in Washington. And there was this guy by the name of Dick Elroy. I won't go into what a character this was, but he could do something that I don't think ever was duplicated before or after. He copied 72 words in a minute of BW. At the same time, he sent a message with his right hand, a different message with his right hand, with one hand, and another message with his left hand simultaneously. Three different things going on at the same time, Dick. And he was making perfect copy. Can you imagine that, over?
There are a number of people who think that the human mind is single-track, that you can do multiple things at once, but you're really time-sharing. There are other people who differ on that opinion. Can the human mind really do multiple things at once? Well, to a certain degree, you are. Your autonomic nervous system is adjusting your blood pressure, your salinity, your breathing, your heart rate. All kinds of things are going on behind the scenes, and you're not even conscious of it. So, for a person to think that the human brain is always single track, well, when it comes to the conscious part of the brain, is it single track? There's a lot of evidence that says yes. But that's a guy in Washington you're talking about. Wow. Can you really time share listening with, I'm going to say one ear, and transmitting signals with each hand? He's holding three conversations at once, so to speak, one listening and two transmitting. Is he time sharing, or is he doing all that in some kind of a parallel operation? Wow. And could you really investigate that brain that's doing that and find out what's different? Was that just training, or is there something unique about that guy's gene? What's your guess, Mel? Go ahead.
I'd say he was just natural. People are natural. A number of different things. You know, they pick up a musical instrument, like, well, take Mozart. His father was the originally head violinist at the court of in Austria, king there, or whatever it was. I think it was Leopold or something. His father, anyhow, was the head violinist. At 4 years old, Mozart picked up the violin, his father's violin, and the father sat there with an open mouth and went, "Mozart, play the violin better than his father." His father was the chief violinist. Then he did this other thing, you know, I guess he was a bit of a character in his own, where he could play the piano upside down, actually lay down and doing it upside down. He could play the piano perfectly, Dick. So there have been people always that could do something spectacular, and you say to yourself, how is this possible? You know, you hear people, young people, you say, well, how possibly at that age, young age, could they have all thought so much up, like in this case, and all be able to write symphony when 7 or 8 years old and all these other things, play every instrument as a professional that is in the orchestra, in the symphony, pick up the violin, you pick up the piano, you pick anything, horns, whatever it is, and yet was able to, without any formal education in each one of these things, just do it. That's amazing. Or how about Beethoven when he wrote a number of his symphonies at the end when he was sound deaf, never heard of him, doing it by picturing it in his mind and writing the notes down. So there are people, you know, over the centuries that have achieved some things. I remember my daughter and myself went to the museum to see the Da Vinci papers. My God, what this guy did by hand and simple drawing tools, I just stood there in awe of the accuracy of this fine work he did. It's just mind-boggling, over.
I guess some of it's native ability, some of it's being in the right place at the right time. In the case of Beethoven, Mozart, whatever, they happen to be in an environment where the family is playing music, so they're continuously exposed to it. A combination of native ability plus being in the right environment. And that's what I think breakthrough really is. The right person in the right place at the right time. And great stuff. There's been a PBS special on the subject of the particular piece of music called Amazing Grace. How come that particular piece of music is so extremely moving to so many people? Or the song Green Fleas was extremely moving to a whole lot of people. Or Morning Has Broken. I mean, for a certain song that a high percentage of the Western world hears that and has a strong emotional response. You and I listen to Oriental music, which sounds very strange to us. I guarantee they've got pieces of music that give them a response that you and I wouldn't get. And what's the difference? Not easy to explain that one. How about you, Mel?
Pattern recognition.
Yeah, that's part of it. I still think there's something more going on. Why do so many people have such a strong emotional response to certain songs? There are certain songs the Beatles wrote, which give people an emotional response that's just out of sight. Yeah? They're very skilled musical writers and creators. That's part of it. There's still something else going on here. And I don't think it's easy to describe. Pattern recognition is certainly a big part of it. I'm convinced that a person who's very skilled at doing chess playing is doing a lot of pattern recognition. And musically, there's a lot of pattern recognition. I used music as a tool to tune antennas. Back in 1978, 77, I guess it was, I built a backyard antenna range, and I wanted to tune an antenna to the nearest 0.05 dB, the nearest 20th of a dB of gain maximizing on a 19-element Yagi. And so I had set up this ratiometry antenna range. You can read about it in, I think it's February 1976 QST, way back in the old days. I had this article on the subject. And that's a condensation of a presentation I made at the IEEE meeting of that day, of that particular year. A ratiometry antenna range really means you've got two antennas side by side, transmitter downrange, two antennas side by side, one's the antenna on the test, one's the standard gain antenna, hopefully having a very similar pattern to the one on the test. And you're comparing the signal strength between the two. Because you're comparing them, it's kind of like a great big operational amplifier, and you've got common mode rejection. The transmitter can go up and down in power, the reflectivity off the ground can go up and down, but because you're comparing the signals between the two antennas that are side by side, decoupled from each other, it takes out most of the usual variations of an antenna range. So it's a little bit like a blind man walking up a hill. The tilt of your feet tells you which way is uphill, and in my case, the signal is getting stronger. Well, I'm standing up on top of a ladder tuning an antenna, and the instrumentation is down on a picnic table 10 feet or 5 feet below me, and the dorsal movement is moving around, and I'm trying to put a magnifying glass on and seeing very small movements of this meter movement representing the difference between the two antennas. I put it into a voltage to frequency converter where the voltage that was going to the meter was converted to a tone. And all I had to do was tune for the highest pitch of tone. And in that process, by listening to tones as I'm tuning the antenna, I managed to find ways of tuning the antenna that I never would have discovered by any other way. The human mind has got a beautiful recording device where you listen to a series of tones over a period of time and you can play it back. Well, you can play it back in your mind. So while I'm tuning a director number 3 of the antenna and my hand happens to wave by the detector director number 5, and I never intended to do that, I hear the tone suddenly jump to a higher pitch and I say, hey, the gain just jumped up. I don't know what I just did, but I got to do more of it. And so by serendipity of listening to tone, I found ways of tuning the antenna much better, and that was the result of the RIW-19 Yagi, which from 1978 to around 1983-84, it was the highest gain Yagi in the world that anyone knew about that had really been measured, not just computer simulated. In those days, they hadn't had great computer modeling programs for things as elaborate as the Yagi. They didn't have those yet. Nowadays, they do. And so I'm in the backyard doing this tuning at 2 o'clock in the morning because the family moving around inside the house was changing the reflectivity of the range and giving me false readings. So at 2 in the morning, they're asleep, and I'm carefully tuning this thing in the backyard with the floodlights turned on in the backyard. All of a sudden, I'm hearing a series of tones that I couldn't recognize, and I thought the instrumentation had failed. I soon realized that a bat flying across the backyard was changing the reflectivity of my antenna range, and I'm hearing the motion of the bat in that series of tones. As you can see, it was kind of a fun process. So, audio listening, ham radio, antennas, who would ever think that they're all musical appreciation. They're all somehow related. You better get to some of our emails now before we start getting a diversion here and get on crazy subjects. KQKEY, KQRIW.
Yes, this is KQKEY. I was doing that here at 2 o'clock or something in the morning. Hear sirens, that up here. See the police department showing up. Well, like I say, I think this was because you see people that even have children, Mozart and all, have a number of kids and everything. None of them can begin anywhere like him. You know, I don't know if any of them around learned music or whatever, but there they were being exposed to it night and day, writing before, you know, morning, I think, write a symphony or whatever. And yet, it didn't rub off on his so-called, on any of the other kids. And, listen, I can sit and listen to it. I love symphonies. I love classical music. I can sit and listen to it all the time in the car or whatever. If I haven't got that rig on in the car or whatever. And, I used to have it on, you know, when I was working in the background and all. And, I can listen to it definitely, but if you ask me to stack any of it, you know, hum it or whatever, very bad. It couldn't retain it, so there's more to it. All right, anyhow, interesting subject, I should say. All these things are interesting. Spending the night on this alone. Last week, let me tell you what happened. Last week, we have, County Radio Club has a weekly 10-meter net. We do this week 10-meter activity because we're in a portion of the solar cycle, of course. Very little HF activity, especially on 10 meters. So to keep it active and all, show amateur radio still has a terrific interest in 10 meters. We have the next spot Sunday morning at 11 o'clock on 28.380. All is welcome. We have 10 meter capability. Take a listen, see if you can hear us. Join us if you can. And I noticed that I'm turning the beam. I have 6 elements on 10 meters. I was turning the beam, and when I let go, it seems like the beam was drifting sort of back and forth with the wind not much more than it should. In fact, I watched the indicator, direction indicator, and it was simply flickering, you know, moving back and forth. And I could see, acts almost like the braking system on the rotor is not working. Well, this morning, got on with the group, and all of a sudden, the indicator stopped working. It stuck on wet, and that was the end of it. So, this afternoon, beautiful weather, I said, better do it, because it's not going to last long. Got my climbing clothes on, up we go. Spent an hour taking the rotor down off the tower, took it down, took it apart, and what do I see? The wedge that locks the rotor when it's in off position, top position. The tip of it broke off. It was about, I'd say about an inch. Yeah, it's about an inch long. But, you know, it comes from somewhat of a fine tip where it locks into the case. It's a ham fork rotor, by the way. It broke off. The tip broke off. And it some way bounced up, got up from there at the bottom, I don't know how it did, and got into the indicating portion resistor and broke off the tip. You should see this broke off the tip. Of the rheostat to arm. Oh boy, I got double whammy there. So, I'm going to machine what they call it a wedge, making another one, but I'm making it out of a piece of bronze. And, indicator, I fixed, used a relay contact, took a relay contact, and, used that as the arm. I put that together, so I was wondering if anybody else has had trouble similar like that with the MM series rotors that take over.
Breaking the brake mechanism, the wedge, and I fixed a number of MMs, and I'm using a number of them, that's rare. Grinding up the teeth is much more prevalent of the gears, and also your 6-element 10-meter beam probably is not wind balanced. In other words, every Yagi has got the feed line going to the back where the driven element is. You've got closer spacing on the first couple of directors and the reflector. So there's a lot more mass in the back of the antenna than there is in the front. Therefore, you mount the mast clamp for the boom of the Yagi, usually at the gravity balancing point, and the net result is you got more boom sticking out in front than you are out back. Therefore, it's a kind of a weather vane where it always wants to aim itself downwind. If you put a vertical piece of metal, sheet metal, behind the reflector, bolt it down to the mast, bolt it down to the boom with U-bolts, you can make the antenna wind balance. In other words, the fact that it always wants to aim itself downwind is creating a continuous torque and a swing back and forth on the ham-ham rotator. And so if you wind balance it, then on a windy day, you'll have no trouble rotating it and it won't be swinging so much. Very few people know about wind balancing, so that would protect the rotator, make it happier. The problem I've got with my ham ends is that the darn screws, when you connect the eight wires, are not made out of stainless steel. I wasn't smart enough to replace them with stainless steel screws, and they rust. And I don't know if you can still buy that portion of the connector. Nowadays, they sell you a kind of connector which is a circular object that screws on, and you connect your cable to it. So I wonder, are your ham ends still running on the 8-screw type Finella connector, or have you switched over to the new connector, which is that round object? K2KEY, K2LAW.
This is K2KEY. Oh, no, I did away with that a long time ago, an earlier ham end. I take the screws out. I push the wire through the hole where the screws were into the interface, and I solder it right to the terminal. In other words, they use the terminal block where the wires are soldered for screw contact. I solder right there. Then I take where the wires came through, and I just pack it up with putty. So if you take the rotor down, the way I arrange the rotor, the cable comes out of the tower, so you can actually take the rotor down with the cable and all at one shot. Rather than just leave the cable up there to drop the cable down. I've got to cut up some ties, where it's helped for the tower. But other than that, I find that's the best way because, like you say, those screws rust and all. So this is the way I resolved that a long time ago. But as far as the wedge, I never had one break before. What has happened, what I did, what I looked at, the piece that broke off, you can see it crystallized. It split in a number of little pieces. It just didn't break off in one chunk. It was a piece of defective metal. And the reason for that is because when they make those wedges, what they do, they have it like, the block of iron, and have like a step where it sticks out then into the groove, the piece that sticks out into the groove. Rather than do it that way, what you do is you grind it. You grind that tip on a slope. In other words, you make it so that it's not a step type of grind, if you know what I mean. I grind it at a flat so that it has, supporting material right up to the tip dip over.
That's a smart way to go, to make it stronger. But you wouldn't be putting as much force on that brake. If you did two things. Number one, have a delay on when the brake slams home. An awful lot of people will rotate the antenna to the right, and if it's a large antenna with a big long boom and a large moment of inertia, the rotator wants to glide for the next 5 seconds. And if you allow the brake to slam home immediately before that 5 seconds of glide, you're putting a large force on the rotator. And second of all, this wind balancing that I mentioned earlier. So there are people who have devised a circuit where whenever you do a rotation, there is a timing circuit that delays the brake release. And when you do that, you can make the life for the rotator a hell of a lot more comfortable, and you won't be breaking the wedge, and you won't be grinding up gears. In the old days, the gears probably were made out of an inferior material, and the gear train would get ground up, and you could buy that as a separate replaceable item. I presume you can still buy the gear train as a separate replaceable item. Is that true, Elderhead?
Yeah, they have all the parts if you want them, no problem. I have that. I have the delayed brake. When you push down there and all, the gear clicks, and then it rotates. And when you stop, you hear it. When it comes to a stop, you hear a click, and it's let go that solenoid that locks it. Never had a, I've had so many rotors and all, turning large arrays and everything. Never had anything like that at all. The old ring gear in there was a problem. It was made out of that cast metal. It would split. So they replaced that with a steel gear that was a retrofit of that. This thing here, this piece of metal, was defective from the beginning because you could see the way it broke pieces off one piece at a time. And it just was disintegrating. That's exactly what happened there. I got that project going. I just now have to finish that up. I'll get a chance tomorrow. Put it all back together, give it a grease, use it all up, and put it back up in the tower, and I'll take care of that. But, you know, I didn't take this apart, which was a brand new rotor a couple of years ago, and only have it a couple of years. And usually I always take the rotors apart, because what I do is I like to make sure they're well greased, and I'll make sure they're tight, you know, things like that. I didn't want to do it on this one. So what I had done is the screws on the bottom, after I had put the wires onto it, onto the screws on the bottom, I packed it with Vortite. You know, the stuff used with air conditioners you pack around that clay-like material. I packed that over the screw, nice and comfortable. But now that I got it apart, I'm going to take the screws out, I'll put the wires through the hole, and solder it up to the terminal stick over.
That's an approach. Where you run your wires to the rotator, essentially permanently attached and not detachable, unusual. You're the only guy I've met that ever does that now. Almost everybody wants to be able to remove the rotator from the tower without removing the wire from the tower. In my case, where it's 100 feet of tower, to remove that much wire would be pretty uncomfortable. I need a connector. And it's sad that the Cornell Dubilier, the original designer of that CAMM rotator, I got to see an awful lot of them in operation in my system here. It's too bad that they used non-stainless steel screws and didn't catch on to that problem. Had they used stainless steel screws, I think the original connector mechanism would have been reasonably reliable. But a real plug-in connector, which is when you go to the websites that supply you the parts these days, they want to sell you this new connector that replaces the original one. And it's more like a standard Amphenol or mil-spec-like connector. Making the conversion is a bit of a pain, because in my case, I have to do soldering of that connector at the top of the tower, or else replace the wire entirely. And it's probably time I replace that wire. It's been there since 1969. That makes it what? 38 years? Yeah, 38 years. 38 years this month. I think it's time that ribbon cable be replaced. Back to you, and you probably should get to some of your email mail. You're going to get behind K2KUI, K2RIW.
Roger. Yeah, I'm even going to add that additional, like you said, multi-pin connector. You want to leave the cable up there. You're going to have to still pull the rotor to get to the bottom of the screw terminal. Well, while you're doing that, you're getting going that far already. You take the rotor down. And, you know, it's been up there a number of years. You should take it apart, take a look at it, clean it up, you know, grease it up and everything, you know, prevent anyhow, okay, very good. And I got to say, while you're doing that, you can solder the wires into the case there and let the wire hang out with the plug, and you'll know you're never going to have any problems there. Seal up the wire connection then with that board tight, and that'll take care of any future problem there with those screws rusting and all. Let's see. We had somebody ask about the off-center bed antennas. Yes, a friend of mine bought one. Comment on this one from Radio Work. They marketed as called the Carolina Wyndham antenna, an off-center antenna. Originally was designed by Jim WY4R. He designed it. He called it the Carolina Wyndham. And it basically was an offset antenna, and then an isolator that he put up there at the antenna. antenna, then he drops down a piece of wire, and then he has a matching unit and all, and he claims that at lower heights it works because the vertical section there, the vertical radius, it works as a much better antenna, and he said he had a lot of success even on bands like 80 meters at around 35-40 feet with this. So that's basically the OCF antenna that was written up a number of times, a number of articles, like the say, USB and a number of the other magazines. And I think it's covered in some of the antenna manuals, I'm sure. But if you go to Radio Works and get their catalog or whatever, want to see more about the Carolina Wisdom pictures and everything, you'll see it in that in their manual, in their brochures, or whatever. You want to make any comments on that, Dick? Over.
Yeah. Of the 5,000 kinds of antennas, the Carolina Wisdom and its various ways of feeding it, with a single wire, with twin lead, with coax, with balance, without balance, off-center fed dipoles, that's a whole subject in itself. Kind of amazing to me that the Hertzian dipole antenna, which I think was invented way back in 1880 or so, 1886, some number like that, here we are still finding out two things about a dipole. People are writing articles about a dipole. There's a beautiful dipole article written in the December issue, 2006, of Antennas and Propagation Journal of the IEEE Proceedings. I just got the October issue. I think it's the September or October issue. There's another dipole article in there. In this case, they're rating the radar cross-section or the effective capture area of dipoles, and they're discovering that if you recognize the fact that most RFID tags are a chunk of electronics connected to a dipole, and the chunk of electronics is a little bit of a integrated circuit chip about 10,000 of an inch square, and it obviously has no feed line. Well, it's got a feed line, but the feed line is less than a 10,000 of an inch long, and at 900 megs, 902 to 928 megs, where the wavelength is 12.9 inches, 10,000 of an inch is not a very long feed line, not even 1 degree, in my opinion. I'll do the mathematics to confirm that. However, when you allow the electronics to feed back signal strength to you, as you rotate the dipole, you can find out the real antenna pattern. Whereas if you fed a feed line to the dipole, and you connect it to an antenna range, the feed line becomes part of the antenna, and at certain angles of azimuth and elevation of rotation, you're lighting up the feed line more than you're lighting the antenna, and you get the erroneous results. In the article in the latest issue of the IEEE Proceedings on Antennas and Propagation, it's telling you about this. So you're using an RFID tag as a antenna range instrumentation device. It's a little 50 cents worth of electronics or 10 cents worth of electronics hanging on the dipole allows you to study various kinds of dipoles. And I haven't seen articles yet for an off-center fed RFID tag dipole. I think it's just a matter of time. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Roger. Yeah, well, I guess the idea has been around a long time, and I guess we're just, I could say, haven't seen a heck of a lot of articles recently, but I know the subject has been covered in detail for many years, Dick. All right, let's see. Want to take another one?
Go right ahead.
Okay, we got one here from, let me see. Gotta be careful which ones I can read, which ones I can't. So that's, I can say, the friendly candy company don't pay me a visit and take confetti out of my handlight. let's see. Okay, Herb, guy Herb, yeah. I'd like to put up a dipole for 40 meters. Okay, here we go. And unfortunately, I haven't got enough room to spread it out. However, can I put the dipole, the 40-meter dipole, I can put it vertically, okay? And I could put it into an inverted L, or an inverted V, however, and the inverted V type of configuration, I cannot get it 120 degrees at the top angle. Which one way do you suggest I should install a 40-meter dipole? He wants to know, in other words, should you install it from the choices he's got, is vertical, inverted V, inverted L, or somewhat of an inverted V, I guess, tip over.
My first choice would be vertical. The number of guys who have got the freedom of thinking out of the box, and are willing to mount a dipole vertically polarized instead of horizontal is very rare. Turns out a vertical dipole is going to give you a hell of a lot more performance than a ground plane antenna with a zillion radials. There's no better counterpoise for the antenna, for a ground plane antenna, than a quarter wavelength of wire that's collinear with the radiator. That's the other half of the dipole. So a vertically mounted dipole is capable of giving you a lot of performance. Vertical polarization reflects off the ground in a more favorable manner. Vertical polarization will give you, therefore, a lower angle of radiation. You probably will get more DX. So you're going to get all the advantages of a ground plane antenna with the extra altitude for the phase center being vertical. Now, a 40-meter dipole is around 66 feet long. It suggests that he's got a tree that's at least 66 feet high, or a tower that's 60 feet high, or he's willing to mount it on the side of the building. That's going to give him a lot of performance for very few dollars. Inverted V, there's nothing magic about the inverted V having a particular apex angle. Yes, you get the best performance when the apex angle is probably something like 90 degrees. The great advantage of a inverted V is that the one dipole antenna that does not have a null. An ordinary flat-out dipole, if I set up a dipole where the wire is east-west, I'm going to have a pretty deep null in the dead east and dead west direction. When I make it an inverted V where the wire goes east and west, I am horizontally polarized to a signal that's north and south. I am vertically polarized to a signal that's east and west. You've got some vertical content to that inverted V antenna. And so in between, you've got various elliptical polarizations. But an inverted V where you put the antenna up as high as you've got in the center, and then the legs of the antenna, you bring them as far as your property will allow, even if that angle is, let me pick a number, 30 degrees, you're still on the air, you're radiating pretty well. Now, where he's got a high enough structure where he can do either an inverted V or a vertical dipole, I would do both. I'd have one of each and flip back and forth between the two with a single pole double throw switch of some kind. In the case of 40 meters, you could get away with a night switch, single pole double throw night switch. But if you want a real relay, a coaxial relay is the elegant way. It doesn't have to be coaxial. 40 meters is a low enough frequency, even an open frame relay in a shielded box will do the job very nicely. So it'd be an awful lot of fun to talk to various guys at various distances, at various azimuth angles, and flip back and forth between the inverted V and the vertical dipole. And while you're at it, make one inverted V east and west and one inverted V north and south. Three antennas. The wire is cheap, the feed line is the only real cost, and the single pole triple throw switch to allow you to flip between the two can do some electronic steering. Now you want to go the next step. You start phasing the difference between the inverted Vs and the vertical dipole and feed them in various combinations with and without delay lines between them. You can see where we're going here. Ham radio operators have made very little use of phased arrays and electronically steerable antennas. I made an electronically steerable antenna that I called the Zoom Control, where I had the 16 Yagis on 432, and I could feed all the 16 Yagis at once, or flip some relays that were built into the phasing harness, where I could feed one vertical string of four Yagis, or then flip another relay where I could feed one single Yagi at the top of the tower. Each time I went between those three steps, there was 6 decibels of gain change. I went from 12 dB over Yagi, over one Yagi, to 6 dB over one Yagi, to 0 dB over one Yagi by using those three different range switches. And that zoom control gave me various beamlets in space, and boy, that was a fun antenna to use. And so, why shouldn't somebody do that on 40 meters? I think it can be an awful lot of fun without very much expense. So few people have done this that when you write an article on it, I guarantee a lot of people will say, boy, it's about time. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Turo.
Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, regarding the vertical dipole versus the inverted V, it depends on what he wants to do with the antenna. If he wants to talk close in, let's say within 400 or 500 miles, I'd say the inverted V would be the better performer. To the higher angles with radiation, you know, making it sure it skips on. If you want to do DX, yes, you're right. The vertical dipole can do better.
And when it comes to the skip zones you're talking about, he's going to have different skip zones north and south versus east and west on an east-west inverted V. The east-west inverted V is more vertical than anything else. The north-south response of the east-west vertical V is going to be primarily horizontal and have a high angle of radiation. And then he can flip over between the various combinations of those three antennas. That would be a fun antenna. Rich, I wonder if you've experimented with any of this. N2EO, K2LIW.
No, I haven't, Dick. I wish I had the moves to do it. But I wanted to comment a great, well-known antenna that I was just having the moves. Popular on 20, 80, mainly 80 and 160. They call it a four square. It's four verticals. You can make four vertical dipoles with phasing on it. And various companies like DX Engineering sell complete kits to build a four square. Very effective antenna that he needed DX.
Again, phased array. Electronic steering is a subject that we amateurs have made very little use of. The Department of Defense has made a lot of use of it, and we amateurs usually lead the pack when it comes to new ideas. In this particular one, we lag a little bit. The number of people who have done electronic steering of an antenna is a very small percentage, and it's time for that to change, because once you have understanding, it doesn't take a lot of dollars to do it. The one thing that we amateurs tend to have a lot of trouble with is understanding what is the name, what is really going on when you talk about phase shifts. If I have a pair of 60 cycle waveforms on my oscilloscope, I got a dual trace oscilloscope, and I got two different waveforms and one slightly ahead of the other. And we talk about the one that's slightly ahead having 30 degrees of phase lead or 30 degrees of phase lag. And what does that really mean, and the sines and cosines of that. Until you study it a little bit, it doesn't come natural. And a lot of people have resistance to understanding phase shift. But once you understand phase shift, the next step is understanding multiple antennas and electronically steering the beam. And so to sit in the shack and simply flip a rotary switch and use various combinations of your antenna instead of rotating a fully rotatable 80-meter beam, I don't have to tell you which is easy to do. There's an amateur in Japan who has a 180-foot-long boom, four-element, full-space, 80-meter beam on top of his apartment building. That's probably a $75,000 antenna. You could get a certain percentage of that performance for just a few dollars in the techniques that we're talking about here. K2KE1, K2LIW.
K2LIW.
Great, Steve.
Okay, regarding the Foursquare, actually I built one a few years back. I was trying to actually do some direction finding. I did it on 75 meters. They weren't efficient antennas. They were verticals, very short. They actually phase shifted each element using op-amp. Basically a pot and a capacitor and the input circuit made a phase shifter on each element. You would be surprised to know you can actually get out of four antennas like that. It was simply by, I guess the closest was 100 feet each.
Yep. And if you can vary the phase shift and vary the amplitude, you can make an extremely deep null in various directions. So if a guy is giving you a whole lot of QRM, and he's only 3 kc away from the the GX station you're working, and if you can electronically null him out, or you're way ahead of the game on any kind of Q multiplier, selective notch, and all those kind of things that you can do in the receiver. If you do it in the antenna, it's going to give you a lot more performance than doing it in the receiver. Were you able to sometimes null out a direction when you're getting QR Mary? Back to you, Steve.
Absolutely. I think I was getting, trying to think now, a null. Judging by my S meter, it was over 40 dB of a null. And I did actually do amplitude also. That was pretty easy, just the gain control in each. I didn't care about the noise figure on the HF band. But I basically did an amplitude and a phase shift. You're right about that. I'm thinking back on it. And I had a certain purpose for it. And I got more than 40 dB of null.
And 40 dB of null is a lot. That means you are taking a strong signal and multiplying him by a nulling factor that lowered his amplitude. 40 dB means 10,000 to 1. You were getting 1/10,000th the amount of power from him as before you did the null. And if you had enough resolution of those nulling controls, I'll bet you the times you could even make it 50 dB. With a selectable match and Q multiplier and whatever in the receiver, you will never get that many dB of nulling. And even if you did, his strength of that signal is going to be overloading your front end and creating splatter and other things that the tunable IF and selectable notch and digital signal processing can't give you anywhere near that performance. So if you want real high performance in a dense signal environment, do it with the antenna first and the receiver second. That's a strongly felt opinion. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Can I make a suggestion?
Yeah, go ahead, Rich.
It is a very good book. He's very heavy on antennas. It's 80, 40, and 160. It's called Low Band DXing by ON4UN. Oscar, November 4th. You can buy the book through the ARRL. I have a copy here that I recently bought. I bought a copy for Barry, and he describes the Foursquare, all kinds of interrays, all kinds of antennas, including temperature antennas, lazy H, everything, for mainly 160, 80, and 20.
And are some of those antennas not requiring multiple acres to do it? Rich, go ahead.
Many of them do, but a lot of them don't. He's got all kinds of things.
Okay. Yeah, if you're smart enough, you can do a lot of electronic steering on 80 meters, even though your property is only 50 foot square. If you put a four square in each one of the corners of the property and properly phase those, you can still do an awful lot of electronic steering. I'll admit that you get full performance out of a four square if you have something like a quarter wave or a half wave on the sides of the four square. But you study the right chapter of Antenna Engineering Handbook or Krauss's book on antennas, you'll find out that a two-element interferometer with the right phase shift between the two elements, even though the elements are very close to each other, still can give you quite a bit of electronic steering. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. Well, combined with the receiving loops I have, that's the whole point that I can null out noise. Oh, boy, noise 80 meters, 75 meters is considerable here. And it's amazing that I can accomplish this with just, you know, the loops in the radio, in the shaft. So, oh yes, there's a number of things you can do. And yes, I know I have that called Open DX, which is really my primary interest in CW. I get on the low band, and sometimes so surprising, especially this past week. I had one night that I was on 80 CW, and some African stations were coming through. Not strong, but enough that I could work them and with 2.5 signal reports. So that was amazing. see that sometimes it shows up on 18 signals that you don't expect to hear on that band, so you got to keep listening, basically. All right, want to go on for another one, Dick?
Go for it.
Okay, let's see. Here's another antenna question. Oh, boy. Boy, oh, boy, we get the antenna question. There's a company that advertises a vertical. There we go again. And they said that this vertical is superior to all the others because, number one, it doesn't require any radio, additional radio, other than what comes with it. And also, the big advantage of it, it has an elevated feed system, so that they claim that their radiation resistance increases as the feed point is elevated. Is this a superior vertical? Oh, I have a feeling I know which one this is, Dick. I think we've tackled this before. All right, you want to make some comments on it or you want to go on over it?
No, let's make comments on this, but tell me what you know about this antenna first, and I'm going to add some comments to that. Go ahead.
Also, they said the elevated feed, you know, with that system. They're talking most likely seen the advertisement for that GAP, the gap antenna system, over.
For vertical dipole?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, tell me what you know about the gap. How many feet high is it? And what do they claim for gains of loss if they do have a claim on melt?
Okay, let's take the gap that I did install for my friend down the block here. It's a multi-band antenna, first of all, covered 80 through 2 meters. It had a bandwidth measured on the average about, let's see, 40 meters, 20 meters, 15 meters, 12, 6 meters, 2 meters. It had a band, on the order of 2 to 1. On 80 meters,